In a coal mine, near Coalbridge, Scotland, miners came upon the bodies of three men. There was no coal gas. There was no sign of violence of any kind. Two of these men were dead, but one of them revived. He could tell, enlighteningly, no more than could any other survivor in the stories of this group. He told that his name was Robert Bell, and that, with his two cousins, he had been walking in the mine, when he felt what he described as a shock. No disturbance had been felt by anyone else in the mine. Though other parts of this mine were lighted by electricity, there was not a wire in this part. There was, at this point, a deadly discharge of an unknown force, just when, by coincidence, three men happened to be passing, or something more purposeful is suggested. Down in the dark of a coal mine, and there is a seeming of the congruous between mysterious attacks and surroundings. Now I have a story of a similar occurrence at a point that was one of this earth's most crowded thoroughfares. See the New York Herald, January 23, 1909. John Harding, who was the head of a department in John Wanamaker's store, was crossing Fifth Avenue, at 33rd Street, when he felt a stinging sensation upon his chest. There was no sign of a missile of any kind. Then he saw, nearby, a man, who was rubbing his arm, looking around angrily. The other man told Harding that something unseen had struck him. If this occurrence had been late at night, and, if only two persons were crossing Fifth Avenue, at 33rd Street, and if a force of intensity enough to kill had struck them, the explanation, upon the finding of the bodies, would probably be that two men had, by coincidence, died in one place, of heart failure. At any rate, see back to the case of the bodies on benches of a Harlem park. No reporter of the finding of these bodies questioned the explanation that two men, sitting near each other, had died, virtually simultaneously, of heart failure, by coincidence. We emerge from seeming attacks upon more than one person at a time, into seemingly definitely directed attacks upon single persons. New York Herald Tribune, December 4, 1931. Anne Harding, film actress, accompanied by her secretary, on her way, by train, to Venice, Florida. There came an intense pain in her shoulder. Miss Harding could not continue traveling, and left the train, at Jacksonville. A physician examined her, and found that her shoulder was dislocated. The secretary was mystified, because she had seen the occurrence of nothing by which to explain, and Miss Harding could offer no explanation of her injury. Upon December 7, 1931, see the New York Times, December 8, 1931, the German steamship Brexi arrived at Horsens, Jutland. Captain Arenkield told of one of his sailors, who had been unaccountably wounded. The man had been injured during a storm, but he seemed to have been singled out by something other than stormy conditions. The captain had seen him, wounded by nothing that was visible, falling to the deck, unconscious. It was a serious wound, 4 inches long, that had appeared upon the sailor's head, and the captain had sewed it with ordinary needle and thread. In this case, unaccountable wounds did not appear upon several other sailors. Suppose, later, I tell of instances in which a number of persons were so injured. Mass psychology. 4. Not a bottle of catsup can fall from a tenement house fire escape, in Harlem, without being noted not only by the indignant people downstairs, but even though infinitesimally universally maybe. Affecting the price of pajamas, in Jersey City, the temper of somebody's mother-in-law, in Greenland, the demand, in China, for rhinoceros horns for the cure of rheumatism maybe. Because all things are interrelated continuous of an underlying oneness. So then the underlying logic of the boy who was guilty of much, but was at least innocent of ever having heard of a syllogism who pasted a peach label on a can of string beans. All things are so interrelated that, though the difference between a fruit and what is commonly called a vegetable seems obvious, there is no defining either. A tomato, for instance, represents the merging point. Which is it, fruit or vegetable? So then the underlying logic of the scientist who is guilty of much, but also is very innocent who, having started somewhere with his explanation of mass psychology, keeps right on, sticking on that explanation. Inasmuch as there is always a view somewhere, in defense of anything conceivable, he must be at least minutely reasonable. If mass psychology applies definitely to one occurrence, it must, even though almost imperceptibly, apply to all occurrences. Phenomena of a man alone on a desert island can be explained in terms of mass psychology inasmuch as the mind of no man is a unit, but is a community of mental states that influence one another. Interrelations of all things, and I can feel something like the hand of Emma Piggott reaching out to the hand, as it were, of the asphyxiated woman on the mountainside. John Dowdy and bodies on benches in a Harlem park as oxygen has affinity for hydrogen. Rose Smith Ambrose Small, the body of a shepherd named Funnel. Upon the morning of April 10, 1893, after several men had been taken to a Brooklyn hospital, somebody's attention was attracted to something queer. Several accidents, in quick succession, in different parts of the city would not be considered strange, but a similarity was noted. See the Brooklyn Eagle, April 10, 1893. Then there was a hustle of ambulances, and much ringing of gongs. Alex Bergman, Gia Sickers, Lawrence Beck, George Barton, Patrick Gibbons, James Meehan, George Bedell, Michael Brown, John Trowbridge, Timothy Hennessy, Philip Oldwell, and an unknown man. In the course of a few hours, these men were injured, in the streets of Brooklyn, almost all of them by falling from high places, or by being struck by objects that fell from high places. Again, it is one of my questions that are so foolish, and that may not be so senseless: what could the fall of a man from a roof, in one part of Brooklyn, have to do with a rap on the sconce, by a flower pot, of another man, in another part of Brooklyn? In the town of Colchester, England, as told in Lloyd's Daily News, London, April 30, 1911, a soldier, garrisoned at Colchester, was, upon the evening of April 24, struck senseless. He was so seriously injured that he was taken to the garrison hospital. Here he could give no account of what had befallen him. The next night, to this hospital, was taken another seriously injured soldier, who had been struck senseless by an unseen assailant. Four nights later, a third soldier was taken to this hospital, suffering from the effects of a blow, about which he could tell nothing. I have come upon a case of the mass psychology of lace curtains. About the last of March, 1892, see the Brooklyn Eagle, April 19, 1892, people who had been away from home, in Chicago, returned to find that during their absence there had been an orgy of curtains. Lace curtains were lying about, in lumps and distortions. It was a melancholy prostration of virtues, things so flimsy and frail, yet so upright, so long as they are supported. Bureau drawers had been ransacked for jewelry, and jewelry had been found. But nothing had been stolen. Strewn about were fragments of rings and watches that had been savagely smashed. There are, in this account, several touches of the ghost story. There are many records of similar wanton, or furious, destructions in houses where poltergeist disturbances were occurring. Also, there was mystery, because the police could not find out how this house had been entered. Then came news of another house, which, while the dwellers were away, had been mysteriously entered. Lace curtains, in rags, were lying about, and so were remains of dresses that had been slashed. Jewelry and other ornaments had been smashed. Nothing had been stolen. So far as the police could learn, the occupants of these houses had no common enemy. A rage against lace curtains is hard to explain, but the hatred of somebody, whose windows were bare, against all finery and ornaments, is easily understandable. Soon after rages had swept through these two houses, other houses were entered, with no sign of how the vandal got in, and lace curtains were pulled down, and there was much destruction of finery and ornaments, and nothing was stolen. New York Times, January 26, 1873. That, in England, during the Pytchley hunt, Gen. Mayow fell dead from his saddle, and that about the same time, in Gloucestershire, the daughter of the Bishop of Gloucestershire, while hunting, was seriously injured, and that, upon the same day, in the north of England, a Miss Cavendish, while hunting, was killed. Not long afterward, a clergyman was killed, while hunting, in Lincolnshire. About the same time, two hunters, near Sanders Gorse, were thrown, and were seriously injured. In one of my incurable, scientific moments, I suggest that when diverse units, of, however, one character in common, are similarly affected, the incident force is related to the common character. But there is no suggestion that any visible hater of fox hunters was traveling in England, pulling people from saddles, and tripping horses. But that there always has been intense feeling, in England, against fox hunters is apparent to anyone who conceives of himself as a farmer and his fences broken, and his crops trampled by an invasion of redcoats and a wild desire to make a Bunker Hill of it. In the New York Evening World, December 26, 1930, it was said that Warden Lewis E. Laws, of Sing Sing Prison, had been ill. The warden recovered, and, upon Christmas morning, left his room. He was told that a friend of his, Maurice Conway, who had come to visit him, had been found dead in bed. Upon Christmas Eve, Keeper John Highland had been operated upon, for appendicitis, and was in a serious condition in Ossining Hospital. In the same hospital was Keeper John Westcott, who also had been stricken with appendicitis. Keeper Henry Barrett was in this hospital, waiting to be operated upon for hernia.